Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eggers.
I just want to be clear. What is there a relationship between the A11 and A12 amendments? Are they? I haven't heard the A11 yet, and I'm not sure that I understand whether one steps on the other or not. Is one an alternate for the other? Is one supplemental to the other, or are they totally separate issues?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Agrins, I think they're related, but probably calling them an alternative may not be accurate. I think the A12 is an attempt to address some of the concerns that Klamath Falls raised. I think the A11, and I shouldn't speak for their amendments, but would be a sufficiently different approach that it's amending not only what's covered by the A12 amendments, but also the bill itself, the original bill we introduced.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, Representative Agrins.
It's your intention to take action on the A12 amendments.
Well, let us have a
We beg that we defer that until we see what the relationship of the other proposals
That's
are.
Fine. Mark, why don't you come up and tell us about 11?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing the City of Salt Caves and the Salt Caves, City of Klamath Falls and the Salt Caves Hydroelectric Project. Excuse me. Some people would say that. Mr. Chairman, let me just, because I have not addressed the committee on the bill up to this point, speak first that the City of Klamath Falls intends and would support any bill that would cause them to have to pay for the process, processing and evaluation of their application before the Department of Energy and the Council. Our concern here with this bill is the open-ended nature of the language that is provided in the bill, that not speaking to the Department of Energy per se. As you know, we've been involved in a very long and arduous battle involving that particular proposed facility, and I think it's fair to say that there have been some agencies that have not been neutral bodies from their perspective and from our perspective as it relates to that particular project. So we are always fearful as we look at fee bills to language which is broad and loose, and as Representative Parkinson said, in the eye of the beholder, that could lead to abuse by a particular agency. In the terms of specifics of the bill, we have three areas of concern. In Senate Bill 39, as it has been amended in your dash 10 amendments, we have one, a concern about what is going to be the role of state agencies, other state agencies besides the Department of Energy. In lines 10 through 11 on page 2, Mr. Chairman, it states the council may commission an independent study by a contractor, state agency, or any other person to do an evaluation. We do not have particular concern with that language. We see no reason why it cannot be a contractor. If the Department of Energy is going to contract with an agency to serve a contractor function, that's one thing. If the Department of Energy is going to contract with a state agency to evaluate a project from that state agency's point of view, for example, Fish and Wildlife, we think that's a very different type of circumstances. I would then take you to lines 33 through 34, Mr. Chairman. And I think this language is a little bit different as it relates to state agencies. Up above, it talks about an evaluation, an independent study to evaluate the application. In 32 through 33 and 34, it says these expenses may include changes to the council's rules that are necessary to evaluate the site certificate application, period. The expenses may also include studies by an independent contractor, state agency, or other person. That's not related, I believe, to an evaluation. Our concern there would be is in the hydroelectric rules, agencies are either required or they have the option of coming before FSEC and commenting on a site certificate. Our concern here would be whether or not those comments and those studies that those other agencies would do would in fact bring on charges to the applicant for the work of those other agencies. The Department of Energy has introduced Dash 11. Our concern about Dash 11, although we believe it's a step in the right direction, is that it is not tight enough, that you're, the council, let's say you have the Department of Fish and Wildlife who opposes our particular project or another hydroelectric project and comes to the agency under the hydro rules and says, we want to comment and provide studies and do work for you on this application. I think that's a real difference between whether that person, that agency, is coming as a contractor to fulfill a particular expertise that the Department of Energy does not have versus the Fish and Wildlife coming and fulfilling their role as Fish and Wildlife Agency.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Costico.
Maybe Mark, you or Mr. Graney can remind me of this because it's all coming back to me now after a number of years. Does state law require other state agencies to comment on applications for hydroelectric facilities?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Costica, I am not absolutely, it allows for those agencies to come in and to comment. I'd have to go back to each agency's own rules or statutes to see if they're required to comment. As you know, Water Resources and FSEC and our application chose to have a joint process by which they went through, so both of them were commenting.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hostica, my understanding is our council is required to circulate the application to other agencies. It's up to them to comment or not.
Go ahead.
And I'm trying to recall back to 85 when we went through this last time. I thought we did require some state agencies to comment, maybe not at your level or at FERC, but I think we did write into the statutes a requirement that some state agencies evaluate projects and offer testimony.
Mr. Chairman, for the FERC process, I think that's correct, but for our siting process, no.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the next area of concern, and take a step back on the agencies. We just want it tight enough that we are dealing with the Department of Energy and we're dealing with those costs that the Department of Energy encounter in the evaluation and the processing of our application. We're willing to pay that. We just don't want language which broadens and allows for potential abuse by other state agencies in the charging back to the applicant. Second area of concern, Mr. Chairman, is in the language regarding legal expenses. This is lines 14 through 17 on page 2, which reads, these expenses, in relationship to the previous comments, these expenses may include legal and other expenses incurred to defend the council's decision against appeals and legal challenges unless the court finds in favor of the petitioner and determines that the council acted without reasonable basis in fact. Let me explain what the law is from our perspective now. If the agency enters an order, we disagree, we go to court, the Court of Appeals, it's an honest disagreement between the two parties, and we win. We do not pay their attorney fees. They pay their fees, we pay our fees. If they win, and it's an honest disagreement, they pay their attorney fees, we pay our attorney fees. If we win and the court determines that there was no reasonable basis in fact, the court may award attorney fees to the applicant. In other words, that the agency has acted without basis in statute and reasonableness. That is the current system the way it is now. What this would do is to change that system. We'll take the same situation. We have a reasonable disagreement of fact. The applicant wins. The applicant pays the attorney fees of the agency. If the agency wins under a disagreement on fact, the applicant still pays the attorney fees of the agency. If the applicant can show the only time they will not have to pay the attorney fees of the agency is when the applicant shows that the agency has not been has acted without reasonable basis in fact. So this is changing the current situation that we're in now. More importantly, I think, Mr. Chairman, is it says these expenses may include legal and other expenses incurred to defend the council's decision. As you know, there are third parties who get involved in these lawsuits. Let us say the council decides in favor of the applicant. At that point, they've decided that this is what the state of Oregon believes about this particular project. A third party brings a suit, or multiple third parties bring suits. The applicant pays for the cost of defending that suit of the state's actions. We do not believe that we should be paying for the cost of those lawsuits that may be brought against. So that's the second area, Mr. Chairman. Our goal, as I've said, is to, we're willing to pay the cost of processing and evaluating by the agency of this process, of the application. We do not want to pay after a decision has been rendered by the agency the cost of all of their legal fees, unless in something, in a very narrow window where it's found that they have no reason in fact. We've presented two options. One you have before you today, Mr. Chairman, that is in A-11. And I describe this as going back to the budgetary process. And there are two ways of going about this. One, we have an amendments, and the second is a conceptual on our part, which we've discussed with Mr. Rainey. And that is that there is some historical perspective as to these applications for site certificates, whether it be Hua Chang transmission lines, the hydroelectric project. In other words, there is a historic perspective as to how much these projects have cost. Albeit there have been very few, and I would agree that it is hard to estimate. What we've presented in A11 is pretty much, it's almost entirely what every single agency has to go through when they predict caseload and they put a budget together. It says that the agencies will determine what their workload will be during the next biennium, that they will estimate the cost of that workload, that they will submit a budget, and then they will, based upon that budget, will set a fee schedule for the assessment back to applicants. Now, the one problem with this approach, as Mr. Graney has indicated and will probably indicate, is from his perspective, they don't know who's going to apply. From our perspective, we believe that the agency knew when Salt Caves was going to come in, when transmission lines come in, when Boardman's come in, that sort of thing, far enough in advance to anticipate what their potential costs are going to be. And so we would ask in -11 that this go through a budgetary process like any other workload increase. And as such, you can identify what those costs are going to be. Now, let's assume that Mr. Graney is correct and that they can anticipate what that workload is going to be in advance. Our second option, which is in conceptual form, is that language be drawn, and we still have concern as to how tight it's going to be and what's going to be charged for legal services and studies and that sort of thing. But language be drawn similar to what was drawn in the Senate as it relates to DEQ and the 401 permits, and that is to provide an appropriation once you draw the limits of what's going to be charged for, to design an appropriation which is going to allow the agency, maybe it's $40,000, $50,000, $75,000, a limitation which allows the agency, when that application finally comes in the middle of the biennium that they didn't know about, they have enough money to begin work on it. At that point, they're empowered to go to the emergency board with a plan. Now they've got a project, now they put a budget together, they go to the e-board to present that budget for that particular project that has been applied for. The appropriation limitation then would be enough money for them to operate in the interim while they received that appropriation. But then any applicant has the opportunity then to discuss and negotiate what that process is going to be. Those are our two options, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. And basically they come down to a budgetary process like any other line item program in any other state budget that we'd like to see happen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mike, why don't you give us your response to that?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going down each of those three points, I guess, the first point on the state agencies and that it not be open-ended, basically we agree. And I think the A-12 amendments respond to that. And I think they are tight enough, particularly taking into account the bill as it's been amended with the PGE and Pacific amendments, that it does assure that only work that is done reviewing the application for the Siting Council is subject to being billed to an applicant. Second, on the legal fees, I recognize that it can seem unfair to an applicant to have to not only pay for their attorney's fees, but also the attorney's fees of the state agency involved in defending a decision that they may or may not agree with. Probably the only thing that is more unfair is the situation we have now where other energy suppliers who are not an applicant, who don't have any interest in that facility, are paying the fees. And that's the situation we're in, because if we cannot bill the applicant or the site certificate holder, the only other source of funds we have is the energy supplier assessment, and that's paid by all utilities and all other, the oil companies and other energy suppliers. We think that it's more appropriate to have the company that has the application pending to pay for those costs. This issue was discussed considerably on the Senate side, and the bill was amended in partial response to concerns that people raised precisely on this issue. And the standard that was written in, that's in the A-10 amendments, the standard of without a reasonable basis in law or fact, was the only limiting standard that our attorneys could come up with that they felt would be something that could be defined in multi-party litigation, because frequently what you'll have is a Siting Council decision that on appeal may be remanded on one issue or two issues. And does that mean that it's substantially affirmed or substantially denied? There's a whole range of possible remands and further administrative proceedings that are a possible outcome of a court decision, not only for our Siting Council, but for any administrative agency. And the Attorney General's advice was that this was the only standard that would work. And the other parties that have testified on the bill have agreed and signed off on the standard. I think it is a reasonable standard.
What would be the impact on the department if 11 were adopted?
I think 11 in part puts us back to a situation where we were before 2 years ago, where 2 years ago you passed a bill, House Bill 2053, I believe it was, that allowed us to recover as an agency the full cost of reviewing a site application. There previously had been statutory caps for site applications as well as for regulating energy facilities, and those caps weren't workable. They were based on the size of the facility. They had no relationship to the costs that were incurred. And the costs and the number of facilities that we get are difficult to estimate. We could have one of these, we could have three or four, we could have none in a biennium. We really don't know often what is coming more than 6 months in advance. And the costs range very widely. The current Salt Caves proceeding is costing about $25,000. By comparison, the Wachang proceedings combined ran over $150,000. The gas pipeline case has run about $65,000. A coal plant presumably could run a couple hundred thousand. I don't know. So going into a budgetary process with a line item like that, and we do line items on everything else that we have a normal stream of business on, our business tax credits, our small-scale energy loans, things that we have enough that we can estimate costs reasonably. Those are line item, but I don't think this would be workable. And I think the DEQ situation with the 401s that was adopted by Senate Bill 168 is very different. And the same committee that passed that approach out for them passed Senate Bill 39 approach for us, recognizing, I think, the very different situation that we have. I guess I would urge the committee not to accept the A11 amendments or Mark's alternative approach, but to that I think Senate Bill 39 with the A10 and A12 amendments is responsive to the city's concerns.
Questions or comments from the committee?
Well, I'd like to, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand how they are responsive, unless I'm not quite understanding them. How does A12 respond to the concern in the bill regarding who pays for litigation? A11 has quite a different approach to that than A12. A12 deals only with being somewhat more specific with the work of other state agencies, but it doesn't at all address that other issue that Mr. Nelson raised.
Mr. Chair,
do I take that to mean that issue in A11 is okay? You don't like that one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Agrins, A12 does just deal with the narrowing of state agencies, where the legal expenses has been addressed in the A engrossed version of 39 itself, because the language that we introduced in Senate Bill 39 originally on legal fees was different. It was broader. The Senate committee adopted the language on legal fees that you see in the A engrossed and in the hand engrossed A10, based on the fact that they felt that was the most appropriate standard. I guess I would urge that
on
this committee.
I understand what they did, and I assume they did it because they believed it, but that's not my question. My question is that the objection that I thought I heard raised was the fact that the expenses of this kind of litigation in all cases are pretty much going to be paid by the applicant unless it can be shown that the council acted without with reasonable basis in law or fact.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Isn't that kind
Agrins.
Of one-sided?
Well,
you call that equity?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Agrins, I think that is a limitation on the council, but the alternative is for all energy suppliers, none of whom have an interest in this facility, to be paying for our legal fees, because we do not have general fund. Our fees that are expenses that are made up when we have a fee shortfall are from that energy supplier assessment.
In the absence of any other way to make you cautious and to not engage in litigation unless you're absolutely perfectly certain, which is not usually the case, you go into litigation because nobody really nobody can reach a conclusion. You can go either way. In the absence of any resources to do that, so that you won't impose the burden on all the other energy suppliers, you would have the applicant pay the whole freight. Is that correct? Regardless of whether he's right or wrong.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Agrins, that's correct, but frequently the situation we're in is that we are sued not by the applicant but by someone else.
Right.
And again, the alternative is either the applicant to pay those fees with the exception laid out here, and I granted it is a narrow exception.
Well,
or
it's no exception at all in my view. Again, you're going to get to a reasonable basis in law or fact. Well, what in the world does that mean? It doesn't mean anything to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Agrins, my information from our lawyers is that is a standard that has been litigated and that state agencies have lost, and that was the only standard that in a multi-party administrative appeal type of litigation they thought would work. That's the best answer I can give you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you, Michael.
What's the situation if we adopt the First Amendment and don't do anything with either one of these?
The First Amendment being...
10. Well, that's all the initial amendments that you've worked out with PGE. What would be the impact of that, Mike?
Mr. Chairman, we would certainly be satisfied with the bill in that form.
Representative Jones.
The amendments, meaning those that have already been agreed on other than the Salt Cave...
Well, 11 or 12.
Is that what you're saying? Or 12?
Or 12.
Well, Mr. Chairman...
The number 10 were the amendments that were agreed to between the department and the PGE people. Is that correct?
And Pacific, yes, sir.
And Pacific and PPNL, okay.
Mr. Chairman...
Representative Agron.
If I may express an opinion, I think that the so-called A-12, the DOE amendments, address a part of the problem that have been revealed. And to that extent, I find them acceptable, but I think they don't address all of the problems. And unless all of the problems, we've reached some resolution on those, I can't support it.
Representative Parkinson.
Could we have Mr. Nelson discuss the A-12 amendments? I don't think he has.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I did.
No, he hasn't. Not
Martin? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I don't think he did it very clearly. That's why we didn't think he did. But anyway, go ahead.
A-12, yeah.
Go ahead. Don't go over them all again, but our comment again, I think there is some lack of clarity by the committee. It may be because we had such a long session this morning, and I don't know if people were... how clear they are at the moment. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, our only problem with the Dash 12 amendments is that it leaves unclear as to whether the agency is contracting with another agency to perform a function that they can't perform themselves. You heard testimony saying that their staff is short and that they may need to go to a contractor or another person or to another agency to perform a function that they couldn't perform. If it was limited to contracting for a function that they can't perform themselves, that would be fine. But the way the amendment is drawn now, it leaves open to the question that they can go to another state agency and ask them and, in effect, contract with them for a study that that state agency may feel that they want in their authority to do. And then we must pay for that other state agency. As Mike has indicated, this would only be with the concurrence of the council. At the same time, Fish and Wildlife comes to their friend agency, Department of Energy, and says, we've got major problems with Salt Caves Hydroelectric Dam. We're opposing it. We want to do these studies. We want you to authorize these studies. We don't believe in all the fish studies that we will be providing in that application that they will be able to comment on, that we should have to pay for our adversary. If it's contract work, we're willing to pay for it, but they can't perform it. That's the difference, and that's why we don't agree with these amendments.
But he's still there. But he'll come back. He'll come back. I can get them all back, but I don't know if I'm left again. He's the only one.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Jones.
Michael, is his concern something that can be addressed in this with some change of wording, or do you feel you do not want to address that issue, would feel more comfortable not addressing it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, I think this wording coupled with other changes in the bill that were responsive to Pacific and PGE's concerns take care of his concerns, because in the hypothetical situation he's raised, which may not be so hypothetical, but I think the council could only authorize Fish and Wildlife to do studies that were necessary for the siting council's decision on or reaching a decision. And if the council authorized a broad-ranging Fish and Wildlife, go study whatever you want to study, I think that could be challenged successfully with the amendments regarding the necessary and just and reasonable that have already been incorporated elsewhere in the statute.
But But if I understand, the challenge, who pays for the challenge?
No, not the legal challenge is a different issue.
Okay. But you're not talking about a legal challenge at this point. That's when you said challenge, I thought you were referring to a legal challenge.
Well, that would, and that does get you into another issue that Representative Agron has raised.
You're talking about challenge, the commission authority?
Well, challenge the commission's judgment in asking
for something that should not.
Right. I think that with the amendments that have already been included, I think the siting council does not have unlimited discretion to study an issue or to ask another agency to study an issue for them. I think it has been narrowed, and I guess I would, with those changes and with A12 already, I think that does respond as much as we could respond to Mr. Nelson's concerns.
Has this been a problem up to this point, your judgment?
Mr. Chairman, we have had some situations where we have asked the assistance of other agencies, and it has been difficult getting their cooperation because of the expenses that they have incurred. The Wachang case was an example, where we needed the assistance of...
Everybody understand the motion? Comments or questions? Not if the clerk will call the roll on adopting Amendment 9 with the change that the two C's have to be identical, that the bottom C has to be identical to the first one. Okay?
Representative Wehage?
Aye.
Representative Agrons?
Aye.
Representative Dix?
Aye.
Representative Hostica?
No.
Representative Jones?
Aye.
Representative Kiesling?
Aye.
Vice Chairman Parkinson?
Aye.
Representative Pickard?
Aye.
Chairman Cease?
Aye. Motion passes. Do I now have a motion for the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair?
Did you do 1 and 2?
We did all those except for those. Yes.
I would move House Bill 2086 as amended to the floor. The due pass recommendation, and would have one caveat that the bill be engrossed before we consider it on the floor, if that's possible.
Okay. Is it? Yes, Representative Hostica.
I'm going to support the motion to move the bill. The reason why I voted no on these amendments is because I think there's still quite a bit of possible problems, at least that haven't, my mind weren't clear. But if everybody else is clear, I think the rest of the bill is good enough that it wouldn't hold up the whole thing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Jones.
Can I clarify? We have adopted amendments 1, 2, 4, and 9, and
yes,
that is the bill that we are moving.
Yes.
Thank you.
And you'll see if we can get it in progress.
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
Now, Sue, as I understand that we've adopted those four amendments, and now we're going to do the bill as amended with those four pieces. Is that accurate? That's all of it.
That's correct.
That's my understanding. Let me say also, as an explanation before, I'm bothered about it. I thought that all the pieces, including the 1,000 Friends, had agreed to this yesterday, and I was fairly happy about it. I do think that this amendment, number 9, is preferable to the current situation. I think it does provide some adequate tests and protection. I wish that everybody had agreed to it, but I think at this point it's better than what we currently got. And what I would say in reference to Representative Hostica's point, and I agree with him, we will be dealing with lots of bills that we won't understand or be sure of about every little piece, and I wish we had more time on it. I wish we had more time on a lot of these other things. We're going to have to be moving, but I think you have to be generally satisfied that we're on the right track. Anyone else? Not as a clerk, call the roll.
Representative Agrons?
Aye.
Representative Dix?
Aye.
Representative Hostica?
Aye.
Representative Jones?
Aye.
Representative Kiesling?
Aye.
Vice Chairman Parkinson?
Aye.
Representative Pickard?
Aye.
Representative Wehage?
Aye.
Chairman Cease?
Aye. The motion passes. I might congratulate the committee. I didn't think we'd ever get there.
Thank you.
The motion... I do want to thank, now, Carol wants to make sure that I'm civil and that I take care of the niceties, and she's absolutely correct. I want to thank all of you for working on it. Did a good job, and I didn't think that you could do what you did in the last hour, but I'm pleased that you did. I want to thank you very much. With that, we will close the hearing, or the work session on 2086. And we'll continue the hearing on 2057 on the Bull Run issue. I think we've got about a half an hour to finish that.
Did you name a carrier?
Yeah, let me give some thought to it. I'm trying to figure out who might give us the best chance. I don't think the Republic is on the floor, actually. Did you say you wanted to carry it?
I'd be happy to.
All right.
It's up to you.
No.
I'm not.
No. I would be delighted to have you carry it.
That's I don't want to.
Are we going to act on 2057 today?
No. Just, we just finished the hearing.
It's 2507.
2507, I'm sorry. The hearing on 2507. Let's get the numbers back. What?
10 minutes.
Do good
yeah.
work.
Okay. I'm beginning to feel like a yo-yo. And then, you should have said I was a yo-yo before I started.
See, I'm trying to get along with my chair.
All right, at this point I will call Dr. Miller and then Don Larson. Don Larson and Don Miller, is that right? Two Dons.
No.
Two doctors?
No.
Two doctors,
here I have
all right.
Some,
okay. And neither one of your name is Don?
No.
Okay. Two doctors, I'm pleased to have you here.
I'm beginning to think about Grandma's garden.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm sorry that we had to have you wait.
Oh, good afternoon.
And you can smile for us if
you
want.
Oh, I will.
All right. Okay, go ahead.
I'm slightly in shock here. Good afternoon. My name is Doug Larson, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2507. And I provided some handouts, some background on the Bull Run. And I think these have been made available to the committee members so that you can probably read along.
Yes, everybody.
Earlier in the meetings here, there were people from the State Health Department and the Water Bureau, and they more or less provided technical information on the Bull Run and more or less implied that all is well there and that the watershed is protected. Dr. Miller and I are here to counter that claim. We believe that the watershed, in fact, is endangered, and we will then now give you our reasons for believing that. My name is Dr. Doug Larson. I'm a limnologist and water quality specialist for the Corps of Engineers in Portland. I have spent roughly 22 years conducting research on lakes and rivers in Oregon and in Washington, including long-term research projects at Crater Lake and at Spirit Lake at Mount St. Helens. And I served on the City of Portland's Bull Run Advisory Committee for 2 years, 1978 to 1980. And since 1976, when I was first became acquainted with Dr. Miller. In fact, at that time, Dr. Miller contacted me and asked if I would review some data that he had gotten from the City of Portland to determine whether or not this data showed whether or not logging was affecting water quality. And looking at the data, I concluded that there was nothing in the data that indicated any cause-effect relationship. But anyway, since 1976, I've been working as a volunteer scientist, and I'm more or less the scientific advisor for the various citizens groups attempting to halt logging in the Bull Run.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, a question.
Doug, just for my benefit, I'm sorry, I've never heard of a limnologist.
A limnologist is a scientist, one who studies lakes and rivers, but primarily lakes.
Thank you.
It's essentially a freshwater oceanographer, I guess that is a... anyway, my position on the Bull Run, which I believe is pertinent to this committee hearing, is as follows. The Bull Run watershed is the principal source of drinking water for nearly 1 million people living in Portland and nearby communities. This watershed in the Mount Hood National Forest is managed by the U.S. Forest Service. Since 1958, roughly one-quarter of the watershed has been commercially clear-cut or otherwise disturbed by large-scale logging operations. Moreover, largely if not entirely because of this logging, extensive stands of Bull Run timber were blown down during a winter storm in 1983. Since water supply and even water quality are things we tend to take for granted in the Pacific Northwest, many who rely on Bull Run's water probably are not aware that this once pristine watershed has been logged extensively and has even been developed for hydropower generation. Over the years, since 1958, about 200 million board feet of timber have been removed, creating sizable clear-cut openings in the forest and exposing it to erosion and other deterioration. Windstorms have flattened even more of the watershed's timber, much of which, perhaps 80% or more, once stood adjacent to clear-cut areas. Once an unbroken stand of trees that protected its runoff, the Bull Run watershed has become honeycombed with logging roads totaling over 400 miles, scarred by caterpillar tracks and littered with debris left by logging crews through the last 35 years. Unquestionably, these land use practices have lessened the watershed's natural capacity to provide clean, safe water. In fact, many environmental scientists and engineers believe that logging the Bull Run has brought continuing, possibly irreversible deterioration of the watershed and consequently has reduced the quality of water that Portlanders must drink. Some scientists and others have urged the Forest Service and the Portland Water Bureau to stop the logging, at least until a determination can be made about the effects of logging on water quality, and indeed no such determination has ever been made. Argument over whether logging is harmful to Bull Run water continues. Unfortunately, sufficient scientific data to reliably demonstrate cause-effect relationships between logging and water quality are still unavailable. Curiously, the burden of proof for responsible watershed management practices seems to rest with Portland, environmental scientists, and the public, rather than with the U.S. Forest Service, where it legitimately belongs. Commercial logging of the Bull Run watershed was stopped in the mid-1970s by the Federal District Court after it was found that this logging did not protect the forest and was therefore in violation of the 1904 Bull Run Trespass Act. This law was soon rescinded when Congress passed the Bull Run Watershed Management Act of 1977, which is Public Law 95-200. The new act permitted the Forest Service to log the watershed, but only as long as water quality was protected. The U.S. Forest Service even proclaimed its desire to manage the watershed for timber harvesting, postulating that its planned harvesting and land use management schemes would not only be compatible with water quality, but could even, quote, reduce long-term risks to water quality while making renewable resources available, unquote. This indeed was a controversial statement. First, it lacked sufficient scientific data to support it, and second, it ignored scientific reports documenting logging-related water quality degradation that had occurred in other Pacific Northwest watersheds managed by the Forest Service. Public Law 95-200 established water quality standards for determining whether logging operations and related activities in the Bull Run watershed are jeopardizing water quality. In 1979, the City of Portland's Bull Run Advisory Committee, whose 7 or 8 members are appointed by the Mayor of Portland, commissioned a task force to evaluate the water quality standards used at Bull Run for detecting logging-related water quality problems. The task force concluded, after a year of careful deliberation, that the data were unrepresentative and that the standards were inadequate to ensure protection of Portland's drinking water over the long run. Yet the Forest Service continues to assert that logging in the Bull Run has no impact on water quality, and I underline no impact. This despite the facts that nearly one-fifth of the watershed has been clear-cut and profoundly disturbed, that an additional one-tenth of its timber has been blown down and is rotting on the ground, largely due to the clear-cutting in the first place, and that water quality data collected in the Bull Run over the past 20 years may not be reliable, or at least not sufficient for the purpose intended because of incorrect and deficient water quality monitoring procedures. It is true that there has been a considerable amount of water quality monitoring in the Bull Run, but after examining much of the water quality data collected in recent years, I am convinced that this monitoring has been and is inadequate. Indeed, the approach now used to monitor water quality in the Bull Run, network monitoring at fixed sites called key stations, has been severely criticized by many water quality professionals, including some who work for the Forest Service and the Water Bureau. They say the data collected through network monitoring procedures may be unreliable or insufficient. In fact, nationwide concerns about network monitoring were weighty enough to prompt the U.S. General Accounting Office to investigate the practices of the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Geological Survey. GAO reported that special water quality studies and not network monitoring would, quote, yield more scientifically sound, useful information on water quality, unquote. Thus, and this is very important, logging has proceeded without any reliable means of assessing and consequently correcting the long-term effects of logging on the watershed's capacity to produce high-quality, safe drinking water. This impression is reinforced when we consider that monitoring was not even started until 9 years after the Bull Run logging, or after logging of the Bull Run watershed began. To turn directly to management of the watershed, for example, let us assume that monitoring indicated that water quality standards were being violated. Assuming further that the problem could even be identified and the source located, what could be done if the cause of the water quality degradation turned out to be an area recently logged or with a vast tract of blown down timber or a massive landslide, and such an area was undergoing excessive erosion that was not expected when the watershed plans were prepared? Water quality degradation cannot be easily remedied once the watershed has been harmed by logging and related activities, especially if the damage is irreversible. Water quality monitoring may or may not allow authorities to determine whether certain activities in the watershed are producing significant adverse effects on water quality. But when the adverse effects are recognized, it may be too late to take remedial action and correct the problem. Recently, in response to a growing skepticism about the adequacy and cost effectiveness of water quality monitoring the Bull Run, U.S. Representative Ron Wyden proposed that monitoring procedures used by the Forest Service and the Portland Water Bureau be reviewed by an independent task force of three water quality experts. This action, essentially repeating the work done by the 1979 independent task force, got underway during summer 1988. A draft report by this second group will soon be released to the public for review. Representative Wyden's effort is commendable and certainly long overdue, but a much larger problem begs his attention, and that is the continuing disregard for the far-reaching consequences of a Bull Run water supply degraded by ongoing logging and logging-related timber blowdown. These consequences could include a filtration plant or some other costly cleanup and treatment process to counter a gradually deteriorating water source, not to mention forced and increasing reliance on other less suitable, more costly sources of water supply. The Water Bureau, for instance, has been developing a well field on the Columbia Plain in an area that is heavily populated and still without sewerage. Furthermore, there are reports now that several wells in an area near the city's well field are contaminated with industrial solvents and perhaps other potentially carcinogenic substances still not fully identified. With regard to filtering Bull Run water, a water filtration plant could or would cost the city of Portland and its water users $150 to $200 million, and that probably would never be necessary but for the logging activities. These eventualities, which are an open possibility, seem to be a heavy price for the people of Portland and other communities to pay, while the Forest Service blithely continues its logging of the Bull Run with the attitude of business as usual. Finally, the Bull Run water source is far too valuable to Portlanders to be managed as an ordinary tree farm for the less legitimate purpose of generating timber revenues that benefit hardly anyone in the Portland metropolitan area. This can also be stated, I believe, for other watersheds in Oregon that likewise supply increasingly scarcer municipal drinking water. Some of these watersheds, too, are being exploited and thus placed at risk merely for the purpose of making money over the short run. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes. Doug, this 1979 group that was appointed by the mayor, did they have any special scientific qualification?
They did. There were three. Dr. Dave Schindler from Winnipeg was one of the people that I believe the BRAC committee selected. The Forest Service, selected someone from Colorado State. I don't recall his name. And the third person was a fellow from the Geological Survey, Bob. Again, I can't remember his name. But all three people, I believe, were highly regarded as scientists. And
okay. You make a statement in here that basically there has been no evaluation. Thus, logging has proceeded without any reliable means of assessing and consequently correcting the long-term effects of logging in the watershed's capacity to produce high-quality, safe drinking water. 25% of the watershed has been logged now. And we heard testimony earlier today that there has been no degradation of the water. And in fact, the quality of the water today, indications are that it's better than it was in 1890, or at least as good as.
He's not old enough to remember.
I like your comments about those statements. It would seem to suggest that, in fact, just by practice, that if 25% has been logged and there's been no degradation, that would be a test in and of itself.
Well, the conclusion that the water has not changed, I think, is, I believe that that's highly questionable. In fact, I don't believe that at all as a scientist. I believe they're basing that conclusion on a little set of data that was collected in 1911 that is probably meaningless because of the techniques used back there. And at that time in 1911, and because of the way the data were gathered, the amount of data that were gathered at the time that they were gathered, I think, does not amount to a sufficient database with which to compare present conditions. And as far as I know, there was no water quality monitoring in the Bull Run until 1965. Any monitoring that preceded that was just a hit and miss, maybe once every 10 or 20 years, if that, and that usually amounted to just a little bacteriological testing in the watershed. And we're talking about the watershed, not the pipe where the water goes into the distribution system. But indeed, the 1911 data, again, I would like to reiterate that is not an adequate database. And if you tried to submit that to a journal, a scientific journal, and make something out of it, they would reject it faster than you could get it in the mail. It is not a valid database, and it does not prove anything.
Mr. Chairman, there is also testimony that the federal EPA has indicated Portland has some of the purest water in the nation. First of all, do you agree with that statement? And secondly, how do you see that as far as the logging operations are concerned? Then, wouldn't that suggest that the logging operations can be carried on if we have one of the best in the nation, or everybody's degraded so badly that even being the top isn't good enough?
Well, the Bull Run, and in fact, all of the Western Cascades benefit from the fact that because of our geology and because of the low mineralogy in this area, that most of the waters have been or are soft waters, low in minerals, neutral pH essentially, clear water, and so forth and so on. That's a more or less a natural benefit that this part of the country that has with regard to its water. But insofar as purity of water, I'm not so sure I agree that the water is purer now. I'm not sure what the definition of pure is, but I don't believe that the water is purer now than it was, let's say, 50 or 100 years ago before they started logging.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Mr. Larson, are you going to give us testimony?
I'm Joe Miller.
Yes, I'm Mr. Larson. Dr. Miller. Doctor, we're starting to get, I think, redundant testimony. If you could summarize a little bit, we'd sure appreciate it. Hit your high points.
My points are all different from what I've heard here, quite different.
Well, we don't want to shut you up, so you can tell us what we need to know.
I think I'll just read my testimony, which isn't very long. I'm speaking as a physician. Who has not had special training in public health, but who has learned something about public health in the 17 years that I've been working on Bull Run. I strongly support House Bill 2507, especially the parts that would require the State Health Division to identify and protect municipal water sources of the state and that allow citizen suits to protect watersheds. My experience of 17 years has been with the Bull Run watershed, source of formerly naturally pure, very pure water for 30% of Oregon's population. In 1894, Portland's Water Committee wrote, after President Benjamin Harrison had set aside the Bull Run Reserve as a closed area, quote, "The city of Portland will have a supply of water which for purity is probably unexcelled anywhere in the world. How much this will count for the future health and happiness of its citizens cannot be measured." This water was so pure, and its reputation was such, that when my family moved to Portland in 1940, ordinary citizens would brag about it. They said it came from a forest that people couldn't even go in, and that it was so pure you could put it in your storage battery. Ordinary people were acting as unpaid emissaries of the Chamber of Commerce. In 1952, an internal memo of the U.S. Forest Service stated in part, quote, "For 50 years, city officials and Portland residents have been ballyhooing pure Bull Run water from an unmolested watershed. Many are fully convinced that to keep their water pure, the watershed must remain forever untouched. There is a tremendous PR job to change this thinking." End quote. It has become evident to me that elaborate policies have been adopted to pursue all kinds of means to enable large-scale commercial logging to go on in defiance of the will of the people, in defiance also of public health expertise. House Bill 2507 will help correct both problems with the result of naturally pure, cheap water for future generations. My next point has to do with public health expertise, which I know something about. The key factor in a water supply is that it should be safe to drink, that it should not carry disease. This is in the realm of public health experts. Yet, in the case of Portland's water supply, there is not a single public health expert on the staffs of either the Portland Water Bureau or the Forest Service managers. Not one. Public health expertise has actually been shunned. Here are some examples. I've got four. Dr. Larson was talking about what kind of shape the water was in as a result of logging, and you asked a question about that, Representative. Here's some comment by public health experts. In 1969, the U.S. Public Health Service, charged with certifying water supplies as being safe for interstate use, in conjunction with the Oregon State Board of Health, surveyed Portland's Bull Run supply and concluded in part, quote, "In addition to reducing the aesthetic characteristics of a water, particles causing turbidity also impair the disinfection process. With continued logging of the basin and increasing mileage of access roads, the turbidity problem can only worsen. Summarizing, the raw water of the Portland water system is only marginally acceptable for treatment by chlorination only at present. It appears that the future will bring a deterioration of the present quality, and that treatment by filtration will be required in the not too distant future." End quote. That this was not an idle statement is indicated by the fact that 3 years later, Portland's formerly world-renowned Bull Run water was given only provisional approval for interstate use, in part because of failure to get going on the recommendation to filter. That was in 1969. The second example. The Portland Water Bureau decided, instead of stopping the cause of the turbidity by enforcing the 1904 Bull Run Trespass Act, thereby prohibiting all non-protective activities in the watershed, to seek a so-called backup source from wells in East Multnomah County, this water to be blended with Bull Run water to reduce the turbidity. No public health expertise was used in making this decision. Since then, this has proved to have introduced serious risks to the public health. 14 million gallons of raw sewage are poured daily into the soil above these wells. Dr. Warren Westgarth, public health expert, warned in 1979 that nitrates from this sewage could be fatal for infants. The third example of failure to listen to public health experts. Dr. Charles Shade, Multnomah County Health Officer, in 1984 warned that industrial chemicals that can cause cancer had been found in wells in the same area. The city of Portland has responded by promoting the largest industrial complex in the state almost on top of these wells. Fourth example. In 1979, the late Carl Green, who had been state sanitary engineer for 11 years and who was then a member of Portland's Bull Run Advisory Committee, recommended to BRAC, this committee, quote, "Before committing millions of dollars for development of a groundwater supply in an area in which sanitary sewage, industrial wastes, and surface water runoff has been disposed of by means of discharge into underlying ground and sand formations over a period of 75 or more years, careful and thorough analysis of a separate alternative auxiliary supply from the Little Sandy River should be undertaken," end quote. The response to this advice was zero. The Little Sandy still is being ignored, and the wells are still being depended upon. I conclude that legal force, I'm using that term force, is required to ensure that public health expertise is applied to management of our water sources. This is best obtained through the State Health Division, being given jurisdiction and authority and adequate funding. Please support House Bill 2507 as being a big step toward accomplishing this. The next point has to do with the citizen suits, citizen lawsuits. The 1904 Bull Run Trespass Act was once called the most uniquely protective law enjoyed by any watershed under Forest Service control in the nation. Yet, even after Bull Run water had been criticized by health authorities because of logging in 1969, as just mentioned, it took private citizens to enforce the law and stop the logging. Water Bureau didn't sue the Forest Service. City of Portland didn't sue the Forest Service. Private citizens sued the Forest Service. Altogether, I have figured Amy and I spent around $30,000 on this. We were not reimbursed. I believe that the vast majority of people likely to want to stop logging